Hey, please the court. Counsel, I'm John Arman of Kennedy Childs, here today on behalf of the Garnashee appellant, Catlin Insurance Company. Although this case presents a plate full of issues, I want to confine my focus today to exclusion X1 in the policy, which I'll refer to as the property leasing exclusion, because it is dispositive of the entire case and because the plaintiffs raised so many roadblocks to it in the order they drafted. And it's also the part of the trial court's ruling that is the least supported by authority. Although this may be because there doesn't appear to be any authority anywhere construing exclusion one or anything similar to it. In finding the exclusion X1 ambiguous, the trial court relied to a great extent on the binder that was issued to the insured at the beginning of the policy period. This was legal error because the binder is merged into the policy as a matter of law and is a nullity regardless of whether New York or Colorado law is applied. I mentioned here that the policy says it's governed by New York law. In most cases, the law is the same, so we're not really dealing with any major differences in the law here. Catlin objected to the binder being admitted based on the parole evidence rule and on relevance, but the trial court admitted the binder anyhow and relied on it to hold that endorsement 8, which replaced exclusion X1 in the body of the policy, was ambiguous, and also in holding that exclusion X1 did not apply to section 1031 tenant in common exchanges. This error in relying on the binder to hold the policy ambiguous and to interpret the policy infected the trial court's entire ruling. Coverage is determined by the terms of the policy and its endorsements, riders, etc., not by the binder. In their answer brief, the plaintiffs don't even attempt to defend the trial court's admission of the binder or otherwise argue that it was proper. So once the binder is properly disregarded, the issue is whether the trial court's ruling that exclusion X1 was ambiguous or that it did not exclude coverage for the arbitration award here was correct when only the policy is considered and not the binder. I think the first ruling that logically needs to be addressed is the trial court's finding that endorsement 8 to the policy renders the preamble to exclusion X1 ambiguous so that the exclusion applies only to products not specifically included within the definition of professional services and thus not to the 1031 tenant in common exchanges here, which are defined as securities by endorsement 7 and thus would be covered because they fall within the provision of professional services outside of exclusion X. Now, if I just want to read the different language first, in the body of policy, exclusion X excludes coverage for claims arising out of, based upon, or in consequence of, directly or indirectly resulting from, or in any way involving products not specifically included within the definition of professional services, including but not limited to the following uncovered products. Now, endorsement 8 changed a lot of, deleted actually almost all the language from the preamble to exclusion X. Now it excludes, under endorsement 8, excludes claims arising out of, based upon, or in consequence of, directly or indirectly resulting from, or in any way involving. And then we have the language, promissory notes, property leasing or buyback investment agreements, arrangements, etc. So what endorsement 8 does is it removes the language from the policy that it completely excludes coverage, at least as far as the purpose of exclusion X1, for claims in any way involving products not specifically included within the definition of professional services. Now, the trial court's ruling is kind of convoluted and difficult to follow, but when both endorsement 7 and 8 are given effect together, which they must be, and in fact, these are clearly intended to replace the corresponding policy provisions, in fact, endorsement 8 says that it is hereby understood and agreed that exclusion X.1 of the policy is deleted in its entirety and replaced with the following. Once it's understood that the endorsements control over the language in the policy, there's no ambiguity because both endorsement 7 and endorsement 8 are perfectly consistent.
What is a property leasing investment agreement, Mr. Mann?
A property leasing investment agreement, I'm glad you cut right to that. A property leasing investment agreement is an agreement or arrangement, it also uses the broader term arrangement.
It's not defined in the policy.
So, no, it's not defined in the policy, but it can be determined from the ordinary meanings of the words in their ordinary grammatical use. I mean, first, there must be an agreement or an arrangement. And it must be an investment agreement or arrangement, and it must involve the leasing or buyback of property. So a property leasing investment agreement or arrangement is an investment agreement that involves the leasing of property. That seems to be the only meaning that can be derived from the common and ordinary meanings of those words in that order and in that syntax.
Why couldn't it also be more narrowly defined to be an investment either in a lease, a pool of leases, as often occurs in the oil and gas industry, or perhaps in a company that derives its business only from brokering leases?
I would agree with that. It could be defined as that, because I think that's what the evidence showed that was involved here. It was an investment in a lease.
Did the investors have any direct ownership interest in the lease?
They owned the property, which is a warehouse in Indianapolis, as tenants in common. I believe they had a fee interest in that property, but pursuant to the purchase agreement they entered into, they didn't just buy this property. They also agreed to assume a master lease of that property. In other words, by purchasing the property, they assumed that lease so that they became the landlord under that lease. And the lease was with an entity called LeaseCo, which eventually went belly up. But the purpose, the draw of this particular investment was that the return on the investment would be paid an income stream derived from rents received by the master lessee, so to speak, from various subtenants, and then that would, after administrative expenses were taken out, the rents would be paid to the investors as the return on their investment. And that's what this was about. This was income producing property. This wasn't, I'm going to buy this property and wait 10 years and flip it. The purpose of this investment was the lease. It was investment in income producing property. So the part and parcel of the investment was this assumption of the master lease that would provide the income stream to the investors, and that would be a return on their investment.
Is that what makes it a security rather than simply the purchase of real property?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that's, it would have to be that to fall under the blue sky statutes and be actionable for a blue sky cause of action, regardless of whether we're looking at Texas, Wyoming, or Colorado law. If it was just a sale of a tenant, fee simple tenant in common interest in real estate, it would not have been an investment. And unless that property was subsequently put to productive use or otherwise held for investment, it probably wouldn't qualify as a Section 1031 exchange. So,
well, here's where I guess I'm losing you.
Okay.
A part of the policy, I believe endorsement 7, includes 1031 exchanges as a security, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and in your view of endorsement 8 is it's not a security if it involves a lease.
No, it is a security, but it just happens to be a kind of security that's specifically excluded from coverage. So if you had a 1031 tenant in common exchange that did not involve a lease, or that the property was bought and then leased in a separate agreement that was not part of the initial investment, that I don't think that would be excluded, because in that last situation, the lease was not sold as part of the security.
But it wouldn't be a security.
But it might not. It might be a 1031 tenant in common exchange.
Okay, here's where I get lost. 1031 exchanges are listed under the definition of security.
Correct.
In the policy.
Correct.
But you seem to be arguing that endorsement eight takes away from the coverage the element that makes these 1031 exchanges securities in the first place.
No, actually, they're included within, by limiting that language from exclusion X1, from the preamble exclusion X1, it makes clear that those are not excluded from coverage merely because, make clear that they're not excluded from coverage. I mean, I don't, we're not disputing that without exclusion X1, the securities of the claim would be within the insuring agreement. However, because they do involve a property leasing investment agreement, they're outside of coverage. It's, endorsement seven provides us coverage. Endorsement eight creates certain limited exceptions from the coverage that's provided by endorsement seven. And so if the exclusion applies, if the 1031 tenant common exchange involves, in any way involves a property leasing or buyback investment agreement or arrangement, it's excluded by exclusion X1. Otherwise, if it doesn't involve one of these specifically excluded types of agreements, it's not excluded and there is coverage. And I think this is why the trial court erred. I think it was trying to articulate a theory that, well, exclusion X1 renders coverage for 1031 tenant common exchanges illusory because it takes them all out of coverage. But it doesn't. It only takes certain kinds of them out of coverage, and those are specifically listed. If the 1031 tenant common exchange does not involve one of these specifically identified exclusions in endorsement eight in exclusion X1, then it is within coverage. In that way, we analogize to the Bentley and Sullivan cases in our brief. And again, there was no attempt to distinguish those cases in the answer brief. Bentley was, remember, involved a field goal kicker for Florida State named Scott White Wright Bentley, as he was called, who allegedly invaded someone's privacy by recording a sexual encounter with a tape recorder under the bed. He was sued for invasion of privacy. His parents turned the claim over to their homeowner's policy, and the carrier denied coverage on the ground that it involved an intentional act. And the policyholder said, wait a minute, it says it provides coverage for invasion of privacy. Well, this court held, both in Bentley and Sullivan, that the exclusion for intentional acts takes it out of coverage, even though invasion of privacy was covered. Now, they held that coverage was not illusory because there are some conceivable situations where invasion of privacy might be covered where it's not based on an intentional act, and therefore there would be coverage for that claim notwithstanding the intentional acts exclusion. And because the intentional acts exclusion did not totally negate or eliminate coverage for invasion of privacy, it wasn't illusory. Similarly here, exclusion X1 does not totally negate or eliminate coverage for 1031 tenant and common exchanges. It just eliminates a certain category of those types of exchanges and every other securities that are otherwise covered from coverage.
But doesn't it take out of coverage the element that would have to be proven to make a securities claim against the broker-dealer?
No, because a lease is not the only way the property can be put to productive use under Section 1031.
And I apologize for taking your time. That really wasn't my question.
Okay.
The broker-dealer is only going to get sued under blue sky laws, right?
We can be sued for fraud, negligence.
Well, you got a fraud.
Blue sky laws are going to get sued under because it has a fee-shifting provision.
Yeah. And you got a fraud exclusion in the policy.
Yes.
Okay. So if the broker dealer is trying to get coverage to protect itself from securities suits arising from 1031 exchanges, and endorsement eight takes away coverage for those 1031 exchanges that involve an element that would make it a security, aren't you in effect saying that the broker-dealer is never going to have coverage for a securities suit in a 1031 exchange?
No, because the a lease is not the exclusive way of making that a security. And I think if you look at the IRC and some of the cases we've cited don't necessarily involve, they don't necessarily have to involve a lease to be a security or to be a 1031 tenant in compensation.
Those are different questions. What, how would a 1031 exchange be a security if it didn't involve leasing?
Well, let me answer your question, and then I'll finish. You have two definitions of securities. One is the policy definition of securities, and the other is the blue sky statute.
And I was referring only to the latter.
Well, my position is that if the security involves a leasing, property leasing investment agreement, it is within the exclusion, even though it would be an otherwise covered 1031 tenant in common exchange. If it does not involve that, and the entire class of 1031 tenant in common exchanges is more than just those that involve leases, then it would be covered if it did not involve leasing. If it involves property leasing, it falls within the exclusion.
I have a more basic question, counsel, which is why can't we just observe a natural distinction between leasing and purchasing? Why wasn't this definitionally a property purchasing investment agreement because they took fee ownership? Why isn't it capable of that distinction as a matter of?
So you're saying that this investment agreement was, should they call it a purchasing?
This wasn't a property leasing investment agreement. This was a property purchasing investment agreement.
It was a property leasing investment agreement because the master lease was not only part and parcel, but I think the sine qua non of this investment, because that's where the money came from. That was the purpose of it. It was income producing property. And the plaintiffs assumed the lease. When they bought the security, they bought into that lease, and that's why.
Which we regarded as, they say, a leased property investment agreement. But, you know, this is not an investment in the act of leasing. This is not an investment in a business that leases. This is investment in property.
It's an investment in property and in property leasing because the property was leased and it was the source of the
It was the point of it.
Can I ask a follow-up question? We'll give your adversary some additional time, too. The trial, and just setting aside your argument that the trial court just rubber stamped the plaintiff's findings, those findings include, I think, an answer to Judge Russell's question, which was, at its core, this was a real estate purchase and sale, not a lease. Now, I respect that you strongly disagree with that, but isn't that a finding of fact that we could set aside only if it was clearly erroneous?
Well, again, it is in some way a finding of fact that is subject to clearly erroneous, but in some way I also think it's a conclusion of law to the extent it's based on the operative documents that form the transaction or the purchase documents. But I guess the real problem I have with that is that this core element theory appears to just come from whole cloth. I mean, it's not, even if the transaction was the core element, it still in some way involves a property leasing investment agreement, and therefore it falls within the exclusion, even though the purchase of the property was a core element.
What's the difference between that, between the core element theory and the point you just made, which is the point of this investment was to take the rents from the lease? I mean, in other words, isn't the court just saying, taking a different view about what the point was?
Well, that's why I think that the court's finding is clearly erroneous, because it assumes that the purpose of this was the purchase of property and not to lease that property out and obtain income from that property. It makes it sound like they just bought something and they're going to let it sit on the market and wait for it to appreciate instead of actually putting that property to productive use. If there are no further questions, I'd like to thank the court for its attention.
But would the bailiff please, no, the bailiff please set the clock so that the appellee has 18 minutes rather than 15. Done.
May it please court, Chris Mosley, registration number 24440. I do have some prepared presentation here. that essentially addresses many of the issues that occurred in the discussion that just occurred. And I'll agree with Mr. Mann on this particular issue. While there are a number of coverage issues that Catlin relied upon at the garnishment hearing and here on appeal, the key issue that they're focused on is this exclusion X1, the property leasing exclusion. And that exclusion, while we believe that there are a number of different reasons why that exclusion doesn't apply, really the most fundamental reason is based upon the question that was presented, what is a property leasing investment agreement, which is the obvious question to be asked. But the answer to that question, beyond just being contemplated from sort of a common sense everyday perspective, also comes from the applicable standards of interpreting an insurance policy here under New York law, which is consistent with Colorado law. And I think there are three of these standards that really come into play. Under New York law, if an insurance company is going to deny coverage under an exclusion, that exclusion has to be set forth in clear and unmistakable language, which is not subject to any other reasonable interpretation. So that's a clear and unmistakable standard. Secondly, under New York law, the policy as a whole, including the exclusions, has to be interpreted from the perspective of a reasonable person familiar with the customs, practices, usages, and terminology in the particular trade or business. And in this situation, that would be somebody familiar with the securities brokerage industry. Third, if the exclusion can be objectively viewed as having more than one meaning, then it necessarily becomes ambiguous and must be construed in favor of coverage. So if we look at the question from that prism, we start from the perspective of what is a property leasing investment agreement. And as Your Honor pointed out, it is not defined in the policy. In fact, it's not a term that's used in the securities industry generally, much less commonly. The record reflects that Mr. Cordate, who actually is here today, is a securities lawyer, been one for many, many years, and he's never heard of it. At the hearing below, Catlin never presented any evidence that this was something that was used at all in the securities industry. In fact, if you run a Google search on it, which I did this morning, you don't find anything. On the other hand, if you throw a TIC in, if you throw a real estate investment trust, you throw a limited partnership in, those terms come up with lots of hits on what constitutes, what kind of investment those are. And fundamentally, they're investments of acquisitions of property that are subject to a lease, but they're done in different formats. So on simply the clear and unmistakable language standard itself, the phrase property leasing investment agreement is ambiguous. But I do think we can look closely at the words literally, and this is part of the discussion that was just had, as to what that is. A property leasing investment agreement could be just what Judge Martinez said, which is the purchase of a lease or the purchase of a group of leases. It could be in the oil and gas industry. The hypothetical I came up with this morning was, a building owner has a number of commercial tenants, needs some cash for operations or acquisition or what have you. An investor comes in, buys out the interest of the lease at a discounted rate. The owner gets the money, and the investor gets to have the right to receive the income from those leases over whatever particular period of time. The investor doesn't acquire any fee interest in the property, just the leasehold interest. And we would submit to the court that's what that is, and that's not what Ms. Rogers and Mr. Thompson acquired here. They acquired a piece of property, one subject to a lease, but they acquired the whole thing.
Was the theory on which the Blue Sky claims were pursued against the broker-dealer that essentially this wasn't just a purchase of real property, it was an investment contract in which the essence of the investment was the cash flow generated by the lease?
The essence of the investment was
I just want to know how was the definition of a security established for purposes of the claim against the broker dealer?
That there was a lease that went with the property.
In other words, investment contract.
An investment contract. Yes.
Thank you.
In this situation, what my client's purchase was this interest. And it is commonly understood in the securities industry as a 1031 tenant in common exchange. It is not understood as a property leasing investing agreement, whatever that may be. So under that interpretation, the exclusion doesn't apply. But at a minimum, New York law, like Colorado law, requires that if a particular phrase in the policy can be construed reasonably in more than one way, it must be construed in the manner that affords coverage. And at a minimum, that's what we have here. The other significant problem with Catlin's interpretation of exclusion X1 is another issue that the court had in discussion with Mr. Mann, and that is the conflict that Catlin's interpretation of endorsement 8 and therefore exclusion X1 has with endorsement 7. And that's clearly seen when you take a look at how it appears the policy was put together. As Mr. Mann indicated, the policy provides coverage essentially for claims that arise from products that fall within the professional services definition. And that professional service definition includes the term securities. And yes, it's a term in the policy, but the base policy defines securities as one would expect a security to be defined, stocks, bonds, those types of things. What was not included in the base form of the policy were 1031 exchanges, real estate investment trusts, or limited partnerships. And that was a significant portion of United's business. And we would submit the reason why United got this policy when it was being bought out. Catlin chose to extend coverage to TICs, to REITs, to limited partnerships through endorsement 7, which clearly expands the definition of securities to include those three products. The problem was exclusion X, and in particular X1. Exclusion X essentially just confirms that there's only coverage for covered products, and then says there's no coverage for products not falling within the definition of professional services, and sets forth five non-exclusive categories of products, one of them in subsection 1 being limited partnerships. That's obviously a conflict with endorsement 7. To resolve that conflict, Catlin issues endorsement 8. And if you take a look at subsection 1 and the list of products that are identified in endorsement 8 and compare it to the main policy form, subsection 1 in the main policy form, the only difference is the elimination of limited partnerships, which is to say limited partnerships are now no longer identified as an excluded product. And that's consistent with the purpose of endorsement 7, which was to extend coverage not only to the limited partnerships, but to REITs and to the type of transaction we have here, which is a 1031 exchange. Catlin's interpretation essentially would eliminate coverage for any TIC, for any REIT, for any limited partnership, because all of those necessarily involve the acquisition of property subject to a lease. That's what you have to have to make it a security. That's what makes these investments what they are. The more, we would submit, the more reasonable interpretation is that endorsement 8 was only designed to modify the list of products set forth in subsection 1, which leads to the question, well, what about the preamble that shows up in endorsement 8? And we would submit to the court that that preamble appears to be a drafting error, because it simply makes the endorsement not have any sense in a number of different ways, not the least of which, as Catlin would read the endorsement now says, X, the preamble from endorsement 8, subsection 1, right underneath that, X, the normal endorsement preamble from the policy in subsection 2, subsection 3, 4, and 5. That's not how one sees these things in a policy. Yes, you can have more than one preamble in an endorsement or in a policy provision, but typically what you would see is a preamble, subsection 1, 2, 3, second preamble, subsection 1, 2, 3. That's how it should normally play out. And we actually have we wrote it out to see what it would look like if the panel believes that would be helpful to see. The fact that this was a drafting error is also supported by the fact that there were a number of clear drafting errors in other endorsements in the policy, specifically endorsements 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, and 10. All of those are identified at page 38 and footnote 10 of the court's order. So we would submit that Catlin's interpretation necessarily conflicts with endorsement seven's grant of additional coverage and therefore is ambiguous. There are two other defenses that Catlin came up with. Excuse me, and I apologize, I have three young kids and they're sharing their cold with me. Exclusion O is the insolvency exclusion, and to put it just simply, that exclusion is very clear that it can only apply if the loss is caused by the entity in which United recommended my clients to invest funds in. And that entity was IP of A West 86th Street LLC. That's who we bought the property from. They did not go bankrupt. There was no evidence in the record to that effect. And as a result, exclusion O doesn't apply. And the last issue that Catlin raised is its objection to Judge Martinez's refusal to reduce the policy's limit by the defense costs that United paid to its counsel in our arbitration and then also in a related arbitration called Branch Avenue, which did involve the same investment, different investors. But that was simply a finding of fact that Judge Martinez made based upon the evidence Catlin presented. And that was, as is in the record, a stack of invoices that Ms. Height, the defense counsel, submitted. And they were, half of them were redacted. As we argued at the trial court level, if you take them and you just flip them like this, it kind of looks like an Oreo cookie. It's all over the place.
That way, couldn't the judge, at a minimum, award fees based on those unredacted invoices?
He could have. That was entirely within his purview. But he had to make the determination, the factual determination, of whether the fees that Catlin claimed, and Catlin claimed them all, were reasonable and necessary based upon the evidence presented to him. And he took a look at the evidence as the fact finder and said, yes, there is evidence in the record, but that's not the standard. The standard is that evidence has to prove to me, Judge Martinez, by a preponderance of the evidence, that the fees and costs were reasonable and necessary. And Judge Martinez made the determination he could not do that based upon the state of the invoices. If that answers Your Honor's question.
It does, sort of. I have a related question, but doesn't the state of the record, doesn't that, I guess, observations and that rationale fall short, at least with respect to the parts of the invoices that are unredacted? I mean, what more did he want as to, let's assume, as to the portions of the invoices that were unredacted, what more could he have wanted?
He could have had unredacted invoices, and the reason why it was important was because I'll use a hypothetical. Let's suppose that counsel's preparing a brief. It should be a relatively simple brief, one that someone might think would take an hour or two. And there's an entry in there began drafting motion. It says half an hour. And then there's three or four entries come in the following days, and you cannot find anywhere in those entries any other reference to that motion. Yet, Catlin is asking for full payment of that motion. We have no idea whether Catlin's attorney actually spent 10 hours or 50 hours on that without being able to take a look at the entirety of the invoice record. Not to mention, if someone is going to go through the invoices to try to determine whether any particular task is reasonable, that can't be done in a vacuum. It has to be done within the context of the entire case and everything that's going on. Not every case requires a particular motion. I have read that appellate courts feel that not every case needs to be appealed. But you can't make that determination without looking at the entire record, and in this circumstance, without taking a look at the entirety of the invoices. Or at least that is the position Judge Martinez took, and we would submit that that's a reasonable view for him to take, an approach for him to take under these circumstances. One other point that we would raise with respect to the defense cost issue is as follows. Judge Martinez, as I indicated, in his purview as finder of fact, determined that Catlin failed to meet its burden of proof. That was his prerogative, and that was the decision that he made. But he also said at footnote 13, which is at pages 50 and 51 of his opinion, that even if he had determined that Catlin met its burden of proof, even there he would limit Catlin's defense costs, recoverable defense or defense costs that could be attributed to the policy limit, to $160,000 per arbitration. $160,000 for the Rogers Thompson arbitration, $160,000 for the Branch Avenue arbitration. And the rationale was, at the arbitration, the counsel for Ms. Rogers and Mr. Thompson submitted a fee application for $160,000, and Catlin's lawyer, the one whose fees Catlin is now trying to get in, objected, said that was too much. And based on that rationale, Judge Martinez reached a conclusion of, well, gee, if Catlin thinks $160,000 was too much for the plaintiff's lawyers to incur, well, that must mean Catlin's lawyers shouldn't have spent more than $160,000 either. And therefore, had he, Judge Martinez said, had he allowed Catlin to deduct limits, it would be no more than $160,000 per case. And if there are no further questions from the panel, I thank you for your time.
I do have at least one. I want to come back to the investment contract theory, and this is sort of the reciprocal of the question I asked Mr. Mann. If the plaintiffs proceeded in the arbitration on the theory that this was a security because the leasing component made it an investment contract, which I understood earlier you said, yes, that was the blue sky theory. How can they turn around and take a different position in the coverage case by saying this, the lease is just incidental to the transaction and the essence of the transaction is your real estate purchase? Seems to me that's trying to have it both ways. I welcome your disagreement with my conclusion.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is merely an inartful way of me to have drafted that. The position is, yes, the lease makes it a security. It makes it a security in the form of a tenant in common exchange, but it doesn't make it a property lease investment agreement. Because you have to determine what a property lease investment agreement is. And in the coverage context, with an exclusion, the exclusion has to be terminated in the most narrow fashion reasonably possible. And it is our view, it was the view of Judge Martinez, that a reasonable interpretation was the acquisition of a lease.
Okay, so you're
the discussion of the core element, is it an acquisition of property, is it an acquisition of a lease? And in our situation, it was the acquisition of the property. It was subject to the lease was going to spin off money. Eventually, there was going to be a resale of the property in 5 to 7 years, that was the plan. But this was a different situation.
Thank you.
Again, we appreciate the arguments of both counsel. It's a complex and interesting case. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course.